Good evening, everybody. Let me first introduce myself. My name is Norman Blumenthal. I'm a psychologist in the New York area. I'm in private practice in Hewlett for about the last 23, 24 years. I'm coordinator of group therapy training at a hospital called Long Island Jewish. Sometimes I refer to it as Long Island Goyish because I haven't figured out what's Jewish about it yet, but I coordinate the group therapy training there. I also, among other hats that I wear, I run a program at Yeshiva University which trains rabbis in counseling skills, speaking skills, et cetera, to prepare them for the rabbinate, and also do something that none of us should ever have to know about, but I do the parental grief work for Chai Lifeline. Some of you may know Chai Lifeline. It's an organization that services, again, I have to say, none of us should know from it, but children with cancer. Unfortunately, over the years, some have passed away, and I do the parental grief or bereavement work. That's not what we're going to be talking about today. We're going to talk about a subject today that is terribly misunderstood, and I hope that by the time we're done, we'll understand it a little better. But we're going to talk about sibling rivalry. And I have to tell you that in general, the importance of siblings in whom we are and how important it is in terms of shaping us, it really gets the short shrift. You know, really, people don't discuss it enough. Now, I'm just going to do like a survey. I'm just going to ask you. I'm not going to ask you to divulge anything. Please, come in. Take your time. Please, all keep your cell phones on. Please, no. Okay. If I had to ask you, how many of you would say, honestly, that your relationship with your siblings as you were growing up had an impact on who you are today? How many of you would raise your hand and say yes? Okay, just about every. Are you an only child? Or no, okay. Yeah, okay. It really has an impact. And yet you hear so little about it, and so little attention is given to the relationships, to the importance of siblings. I do this bereavement work for Chai Lifeline. What we basically do is we have a weekend for family, again, for parents who've lost children. And they come with their family. And the very first weekend, what they did was the parents stayed in a guest house and the children were put in bunks. It was done in the camp. And children were put in the bunks by their age group. So all the 8-year-olds, 8, 9-year-olds were in one bunk and 10, 11-year-olds were in another bunk. And we had very first weekend, we had somewhere between 20 and 25 families. And none of them, not one of the families, told the children why they were coming to this weekend. Now, they lost a sibling. But not one of them were told why they were coming to the weekend. And what would happen is they'd sit in the bunk, and they'd start meeting everybody. And they'd say, how many brothers and sisters do you have? So, well, I have two brothers, but I had a sister who died. So, well, I had a brother who died. And the kids would come running back to their parents and say, guess what? Everybody in our bunk had somebody who died. And they didn't put it together until we realized as well, wait a minute, we're neglecting the siblings. We're not addressing the impact on the siblings. So it's a terribly overlooked and forgotten aspect of our lives. So what I hope to accomplish today is two things. I'm going to hopefully accomplish to give you a sense of what function, we're going to talk specifically about sibling rivalry, but what function sibling rivalry serves, and then you'll know, as parents, once you know what function it serves, how to address it and how to handle it. In fact, I have here a book, which is probably the most popular book on the issue of sibling rivalry. It's called Siblings Without Rivalry. I don't agree with that book, and it's probably audacious on my part, because I don't think it's right. In fact, the research doesn't agree with the book, because the research shows that sibling rivalry is universal, that all families have sibling rivalry, and in fact, the families that where there is no sibling rivalry is usually families that are having problems, are usually dysfunctional families. So if your kids are tearing each other's eyes out, that's probably a sign that you have a pretty normal family. So there's a great deal of relief when I tell people that. But if you think about it for a second, if your parents are throwing dishes at each other, what do the kids typically do? They cling to each other and take care of each other. The fact that they're in a home that's a relaxing home is that they have the luxury of fighting with each other. So I don't think it's really right to say siblings without rivalry. There should be rivalry, and that's the point I'm going to make, and that's hopefully it'll make sense to you by the time I'm done. It should be manageable rivalry, and once we understand what function sibling rivalry serves, then we'll, as I said, optimally then we'll know how to deal with it. Actually, everybody likes to tell their stories, so since I'm hogging the microphone, I'll tell you my favorite sibling rivalry story. I have four children, Kainahara, and I remember when my second child was born, my oldest was 3 years old, and of course we took her to the hospital and whole big fuss, and then, you know, the babies were all lined up, and I picked her up and I pointed out, so you see that baby over there? That's your brother. And she takes one look and she points to the baby next to it and says, I like that one better. She didn't waste a minute's time. Although she grew up in the Five Towns, maybe she thought she was shopping. I mean, I don't know. But but in this book, Sibling Without Rivalry, they actually do an exercise. And I'll do the exercise with you because I think it gives us a sense of what kind of horror we visit upon our children when we produce siblings for them. And I'm not going to ask you to write anything or say anything, but they describe various scenarios and they tell you what your reaction should be or what your reaction is. Okay? Imagine that your spouse puts an arm around you and says, "Honey, I love you so much and you're so wonderful that I've decided to get another wife just like you." Okay, your reaction. Okay, and this again is, we're obviously focusing on the wife. When the new wife finally arrives, you see that she's very young and kind of cute. When the three of you are out together, people say hello to you politely, but exclaim ecstatically over the newcomer, "Isn't she adorable? Hello, sweetheart. You are so precious." Then they turn to you and ask, "How do you like your new wife?" Okay, your reaction. The new wife needs clothing. Your husband goes into your closet, takes some of your sweaters and pants and gives them to her. When you protest, he points out that since you've put on a little weight, your clothes are too tight on you, they'll probably fit her perfectly. Your reaction. It goes on. I think you get the sense of what they're trying to say. So this is what we visit upon people. So again, what function? And by the way, just to backtrack a little bit in terms of how neglected sibling issues are, and since this is taking place in a synagogue, we should point out as well, if we think about even in the Bible, in the Torah, how important sibling relationships are. Joseph and his brothers, Isaac and Esau, I mean, across the board, siblings play a very crucial role. So let's talk about what function sibling rivalry serves. If again, it's normal, some of you wanted it, it's universal, it's a sign of a healthy home. So if there is such a thing, and if it's occurred since time immemorial, I mean, let's face it, Cain and Abel, I mean, just from the world was created, and there was sibling rivalry, what function does it serve? And basically, sibling rivalry serves two functions. It teaches our children, number one, conflict resolution. And specifically, how to resolve conflicts, how to resolve differences, and specifically, how to resolve differences and conflict between their contemporaries. Okay? In other words, the child will have conflict with parents. That's the next talk. Okay? There are hierarchical relationships where there may be some tension. But in the course of life, you're going to have contact. If we fast forward to adulthood, you're going to have contact with your contemporaries, with your peers, and there may be differences. There may be differences between you and your spouse. There may be differences between you and your co-workers. There may be differences between you and neighbors, between you and fellow congregants in your synagogue. How do you know how to resolve that? How do you know how to handle it? How do you know how to assert yourself while not letting it get out of hand and not letting it get violent, etc.? Well, that has been, you've been successful and you're able to do that because you practiced on your brother and sister. So one of the functions, and again, why it's important, again, if we look in general, since this whole focus is on parenting and childhood is a laboratory. Childhood is the dress rehearsal for life. Whenever we have to decide how to handle a child or what we should expose them to or not, we have to just fast forward to adulthood. Will this prepare the child to be a functioning adult? So one of the skills you need in life is to be able to resolve differences. And sibling rivalry is the laboratory where you learn how to resolve differences. And again, this will have bearing on how you handle the conflicts that emerge with your children. The other important lesson of sibling rivalry, the other function that sibling rivalry serves. And again, you know, one of the things that happens is, since we've mastered many of these skills, we take them for granted. So same thing like even with conflict resolution. I may talk to you now about this being conflict resolution. Most of us are probably pretty successful at that, so we don't realize that we weren't born knowing how to do that, that we had to learn. But there's another, an awareness, an ability that we develop through sibling rivalry. And that's basically that life is not fair. And life is not fair. Some people are wealthier than others. Some people are more good-looking than others. Some people are healthier than others. Some people have more nachas than others. There really is, you know, if you want to wax religious about it, you can say, well, you know, from God's perspective, everything is fair, but we don't understand it. But from as mere mortals, from our vantage point, the life isn't fair. Things don't happen fair. There's a concept of bad things happening to good people. But even if we don't go that radical, even if we don't go that far to look into tragedy, if you look around, you're living in a particular house, and your next door neighbor is living in a better house. There's actually a famous story of a guy who once came to a famous rabbi and said to him, he was complaining, he said, you know, I'm in this and this business. A guy across, I'm making $10,000 a year. The guy across the street is in the same business and he's making $20,000. He said, don't worry, it'll get better. Comes back a few months later, he said, yeah, it got better. I'm making $30,000, but the guy across the street is making $90,000. I don't understand. So where it get better? Comes back a lady, said, yeah, okay, I'm making $50,000, but the guy across the street is making $250,000. Why is he more successful than I am? And the rabbi said to him, because he's running one business and you're running two businesses. You know, you're running his and yours. But we make comparisons. We look around and we see other people are better off. How do we handle that? How do we know how to handle it? How do we somehow cope with that? And the way we cope with that has, we develop that ability to cope with that through sibling rivalry, through the conflict. And that's often the battle cry of the children. He got more, he can sleep, he can go to bed later, etc. And I remember as a kid, my father used to say that he, when we at the table, that he has to count the bubbles in the Coca-Cola, because it never was fair who got more and who got less, etc. But that's what the kid is learning, what the kid is struggling with, is this reality. That life is sometimes unfair, and there are inequities. So this ability, this develops in the course of sibling rivalry, and the kid's complaint is the kid attempting, again, he's not born with this awareness, is the kid's attempt to try to understand why there are inequities in life, why there are or seemingly inequities in life. And by managing sibling rivalry correctly, we teach the children how to cope with this. And that's the fact that my guess is most of you are able to deal with this kind of jealousy or deal with these inequities is because your parents helped you when you were fighting with your brothers and sisters. So with this in mind, and again, that's why I have a problem with this whole idea of siblings without rivalry. We need sibling rivalry. We need it for those basic skills, for the ability to resolve conflict. And we also need it for this ability to learn to swallow this bitter pill that life is unfair. With this in mind, this will govern how we should manage or how we should deal with this, with the kind of conflicts that emerge with our kids. Number one, don't play King Solomon. Don't try to figure out who started. You'll never figure it out. If there is such a thing in family life as spontaneous combustion, or what's called in Hebrew Yesh Me'ayin, or the Big Bang Theory, that's sibling rivalry. It just erupts. And if you're going to try to figure out who started, you're never going to win. You're never going to figure it out. It's in the air. It's in the atmosphere. So you never get caught up with, and every kid's going to tell you, this one started, this one's his fault, it's that one's fault. You don't get involved. You don't try to figure out who started. As much as possible, and here we go back again to the idea that sibling rivalry is an attempt to deal with, to learn conflict resolution. As much as possible, hand the onus of responsibility to solve the problems or to solve the conflict back on the children. If you solve it for them, if you get too actively involved, they're not going to develop these very skills that we want them to have. And again, later on in life, will they have the skills to resolve conflicts with spouses? Will they have the skills to resolve conflicts with neighbors, with coworkers, etc.? So the job should be as much as possible to put it back on the children to resolve the differences. Okay, so let me give you just some examples, okay? For example, the children are fighting over a toy. Well, let's say they're fighting over what show to watch on TV or something like that. Instead of trying, first of all, figure out who started and whose fault it is, etc., and instead of trying to resolve it, okay, you got a half hour, instead of you're doing it yourself, one of the ways to do it is to take away the remote control, if it's a TV, or take away the toy, and say, when you guys can figure out how to share it, you'll get the toy back. Put it back on them. Why? Because, again, they're going to now develop the skills. Now there's a mutual shared incentive to solve this difficulty, to solve this difference. And if they do it themselves, it's a skill that they've developed. If you do it for them, there may be times you have to do it for them, we'll talk about that, but if they develop it themselves, that's a skill now that they have. So I remember I used to tell my children when they were younger, I have no toys, you have lots of toys. This toy is my toy until you can share it. And you'll be surprised when you do something like that, how quickly they figure out how to solve the differences. And now you've given them something. You've given them a skill. Now, also, by the way, let me share with you a secret. I haven't proven this to be a fact, but I hold it to be true, and I think I'll prove it one of these days. car manufacturers put something in the ventilation system of cars that increased sibling rivalry and fighting. I don't know exactly what they're doing, but as soon as they get into that car, it's World War III. So then you buy like a mini bus for the two children that you have because you want to keep them apart as much as possible, right? And somehow or another they find each other and they go after each other. We haven't quite discovered yet what they're doing, but it's a definite fact that there's something about the car that makes it an absolute hell. And so again, a technique that I have used, but you can use variations on the theme. When my kids are now older, but when they were younger, and the battles used to begin in the car, I would pull the car over, pull over to the side of the road, and say, when you're finished, we'll continue. Now, this was a problem on the George Washington Bridge, admittedly, you know, as I used to hear the traffic reports, there goes Blumenthal again, trying to solve his children's conflicts, you know, so there's a backup on the track, but I mean, you know, it's the same idea. The onus of responsibility is on the children to solve their differences. Now, and I got to tell you, it works like a charm. You'll be within no time. They would find some way to resolve their differences. They would find some way to work it out. And again, if they work it out themselves, that's a lifelong skill that they have. And then one more thing. And this is an important point again, because I said there are two, and a lot of you straggled in, so I'm going to repeat this. There are basically two functions of sibling rivalry. One is conflict resolution, to learn how to resolve differences, and the other one is to learn that life is not fair. Don't try to be 100% fair. As I said, my father used to say, he used to count the bubbles in the Coca-Cola. You can't. First of all, you simply can't. There are inequities. A 10-year-old is going to go to sleep later than an 8-year-old. A 12-year-old can go on his bike further places than a 10-year-old. There are inequities, and sometimes even if you have identical twins, you know, there'll be differences. One may have more friends, one may have skills that the other one doesn't. I was working with a family recently that they had fertility problems, and they had triplets, and two of the triplets are superstars, and one's got learning disabilities and difficulties, etc. It's very hard, you know. There are inequities. And if you're going to try desperately to make everything fair, first of all, you're going to fail because we can't do it. You know, life isn't like that. We can't portion out things exactly. And paradoxically, you're doing the child a disservice. It's no different than a parent who tries to give the kid everything they want. You know, they may think they're doing the child a favor, but they're not preparing the child for life. Because in life, you don't get everything you want. And the first time that child is frustrated, they have a very hard time. The same thing here. If we try to make everything 100% equal, that every time, you know, when one kid has a birthday and he gets 25 presents, you give 25 presents to the other kid, I mean, you try everything always to be equal, you're not preparing your child for life. So think now, I'm not saying you purposely create major inequities to prepare your kid for life, you know. You don't have to, life alone, circumstances alone will provide that and will give you those opportunities. But there are inequities, and that's never. Come on, take a seat anywhere. Don't be back. Sit next to the teacher. You'll get called on. You know, don't. It's interesting. People are always scared to sit up front. You know, like, okay. So you can't be 100. I said you try to be as fair as possible, but there will be inequities. And if there's the normal discrepancies, if there are, you know, if a certain, as I said, let's say one kid gets an invitation, one kid has a certain friend who has this wonderful house with a swimming pool and arcade, and he gets an invitation, the other child doesn't. Normal kind of things that happen in life. If you try to make it up constantly, you're not helping the child. The child has to learn to accept, the child has to learn as well, just like we do, just like we come to terms with the fact that some people seem to have it better off than we do. That's the normal sibling rivalry, and that's the way you manage the normal kind of conflict that exists between children. And again, I want to say that's where I differ with this book, that there should be sibling rivalry. It should be manageable sibling rivalry. Let me talk a little bit about some of the abnormal situations, some of the situations that where it may be, you know, outside the realm of what's normal and how to handle those kind of situations. First of all, if the conflict between the siblings is excessive and exclusive. In other words, the normal situation is, and I hear this all the time from parents, when they're getting along, they get along like a house on fire. They're getting along fabulously, they play, et cetera, and when they're fighting, they're killing each other. And let me say a little something about fighting. It's a very interesting thing, especially if you have boys, although girls can be pretty aggressive too, but especially if you have boys. The very interesting thing about fighting, boys will fight, and somehow or another, there's an unwritten rule. They know just how far to go. I used to be a psychologist in the school, and it was actually the school where my kids went. And there are two things, if you ever are at your children's school, that you should never witness. Especially if you have problems with your blood pressure. One thing is called recess, and the other is called dismissal. Dismissal is the scariest thing in the world. You have about 25 identical yellow buses. You have about 800 kids all walking in different directions, and by some miracle, they all land up at home. How it happens, I don't know, but it's the scariest thing in the world to watch. The other thing that's a scary thing to watch is something called recess. What goes on there is unbelievable. It is like balls flying all over the place, bodies falling, fighting, scratching, banging, falling, and then suddenly the teacher blows the whistle, and they're all in one piece, and they line up, and they go back to class. How it happens, I don't know. But I remember, even as a psychologist, sometimes I would want to have to observe a child, especially if there was questions of social skills, and I would have to, as far as the kid was concerned, I was just on recess duty, but I was observing a child, and it's a scary thing. But one of the things you'll watch in the course of recess is, in the normal course of events, invariably, the boys, more so than the girls, will get into a fight. And you know something? It's interesting. They know just how far to go. They know where to hit. They know where to push. They know when to stop, so that it doesn't get out of hand, except for the kids with problems. So again, the kids with what we call the dysregulatory disorders, the kids like, the ADD kids, et cetera, the ones, and you all know what ADD is? Right, it's what's afflicting most of you now while I'm talking. It's an inability to focus, pay attention. Okay, so even if the kids, boys in particular, will get into fights, it's not the end of the world, unless it gets out of hand. And you'll see that in a normal home, the boys will push, they'll shove, they'll hit. I'm not saying you let it get away with it. But, that's what brings you up to a point. Okay, I'll get there in a second. But still, it is sort of normal. They know how far to go. In situations where a kid is actually getting hurt, in situations where there's a kid really hitting where they shouldn't hit, then there's something wrong. But again, abnormal sibling rivalry is when it really defines their relationship, or when the fighting gets out of hand. When I just had a situation now where a kid went to the kitchen and took a knife to go after his brother. That's not normal sibling rivalry, okay? That's when it's excessive. And by the way, it is also not normal sibling rivalry when there's a child much older, when there's a huge age gap, and there's this kind of ongoing rivalry. Your 16-year-old should not be involved in sibling rivalry with the 8-year-old. That's sometimes an indication of something not being right. Usually, it's the children in the contiguous ages, the children closest in age, especially if they're same-sex children. And so you'll get a little bit cross-gender. But usually, if it's two boys close in age or whatever, that's the most typical and common type of sibling rivalry. So if you have an older child and a much younger child, or if you have a teenager jealous, if you have like a huge age gap, jealous of an infant, that's not normal. Then there's something wrong. First of all, one very effective technique, and this sort of goes back to what I said earlier, and again, I know stragglers are coming in, and one of the points I was trying to make is a sibling rivalry is normal, but they need to grow up. One very effective intervention, if things get out of hand, is to put the punishment on both of them, if a punishment is warranted. You have two boys, they start fighting, and invariably, he started, and as I said to you earlier, you'll never figure out who started. It's spontaneous combustion. It just comes out of no place. Punish both of them. Put the onus of responsibility on both of them. You both have to go to your room. If you two can't get along, if I have one more fight with you tonight, there'll be no dessert tonight. There'll be no dessert. But he, but she, but he, but they, they. Now this, you're not taking sides. You're putting it again back on them. It's a very effective. It's effective, by the way, in another respect as well. By putting the punishment on both of them, there's two things that happen. First of all, if you have one child who is, and I was going to get to that later, but I'll talk about it now, who is like a professional victim, you can have that, a kid who's often picked on, etc. By lumping them together with the one who's the aggressor, now suddenly you made him an aggressor. I used to do this I told you I was a psychologist in a school, and sometimes it would happen that a kid was starting up with another kid. So you had this big, tough, bully kind of kid starting up with this wimpy little kid. And what I would do is I would have the assistant principal call them in and give it to them. Let them have it. By the way, the assistant principal is the worst job in a school, right? Because you do all the dirty work, you get none of the credit. I don't know if anybody's assistant principal's here. But let them have it. Really give it to both of them. and several things, and then put them in a room and say, you better figure out how to get along, or I'm throwing you out of the school. Now, two things have happened. Suddenly, I took this weaker kid, who often sees himself as a victim and picked on, and I lumped them together, you know, with Incredible Hulk over here. Now, they're one group. So I've enhanced, in a way, his self-esteem. But the other thing is, and that is a common human nature, common problem, a common phenomena. And if any of you took Psych 1, are you familiar with the Sharif study? Anyone remember the Sharif study? So let me tell you about that. You learned about it in Psych 1 if you took Psych 1. Sharif was a guy who wanted to study competition among children. So he went to a sleepaway camp, and he set up a highly competitive situation. And he took his notes, and he made his observations. And when he was all done, he was ready to go home. And the camp director said, no, well, you did me such a favor. I have my camp. They're ready to kill each other. You got to fix it, you know? So he was stuck with this. So what he did, which is what he's now famous for, is not the original study, was he created some external threat, some outside situation that was threatening them. And that unified the whole camp. Something we see all the time, and unfortunately, if we look at it politically, the only time the Israelis get along is when they're threatened by the Arabs. Or a similar thing, I know my mother said that, when my children were born, she said in Europe they used to call grandchildren, if any of you know Yiddish, Seinem von der Seinem, which means the enemies of the enemies. The reason why grandparents and grandchildren get along so well is that they have a mutual enemy, and to this day she calls my kids a Seinem von der Seinem. But there is nothing unites people more than have a common enemy. When you punish both kids, and you've given them time out or deprived them of some treat, now they hate you more than they hate each other. Well, that's the way it's supposed to be, you know?
They start bullying each other over there.
I'll get to that, okay? We'll get when there's a disparity like that. But anyway, but it's a very effective technique. So again, you're being fair. You're not getting a while, you're not involved, you're not getting showing favorites. So it's an effective technique. But again, there can be excessive sibling rivalry, and we'll talk about that, what to do about that in a minute. One other point, by the way, and this is a common mistake, well-meaning, that parents make. Don't force your kids, or don't put pressure on your kids to love each other. Because if one thing you want to guarantee the fact that they won't, is to try to make them. Love, like any feeling, has to be spontaneous, has to be natural. And I want to tell you something, and I'm sure there are people here who can say it. I can't tell you how many times I hear adults tell me that when I was a kid, my brother and I, we killed each other. We were at each other's throats, and today we're very close. It happened. Because again, it's a normal, natural phenomena. So if the kid comes in and says, I hate him, and I'm going to hate him until the day he dies, and you're entitled to your feelings, you know, don't worry. And it's like kids threatening to run away from home. You know, it lasts a minute. I mean, one of my kids once announced that she's moving to the backyard. She took all her stuff, and she lasted 5 minutes in the backyard. But actually, I had a cousin once who threatened his parents that he was going to run away from home. And when he saw his parents weren't impressed, he said, well, I'm going to run away from home and become conservative. He figured he'd really get them. But you can't impose love. It's okay if they want to say that they want to hate their sibling. But again, if it's excessive and if it's, as I said, exclusive, it's probably an indication of one of two things. It could be that one, if not both of the children, do have one of these problems with controlling themselves. It could be a kid. Again, we call them dysregulatory. In other words, the kids with probably the most common problem is ADD, where they can't contain themselves. They can't control themselves. That once the aggression is set off, they don't have that built-in self-control to know just how far to go. As I said, it's most kids do. And that may be a sign of more of a personal problem for that particular child that needs to be addressed, or for both children, than actually an issue of sibling rivalry. Or if it is excessive and if it's out of hand, it may be a deflection of other concerns or problems. It could be children are not very precise with their feelings, as adults aren't great either, but are better. So a child sometimes who's depressed, who's sad, will express it through anger. Will not even express it through assaultive kind of behavior. So it may be unhappiness and maybe concerns, problems that really may be a reflection, and again, not always, I don't want people panicking. Sometimes it could be problems in the home. It could be a child's attempt to displace the distress over parents who are fighting, or stress that occurs in the family. A parent who's ill, or financial difficulties, etc., and the child's frustration, since it can't find an outlet where it's supposed to be, will make it displaced on a sibling. And by the way, this kind of thing is called scapegoating. as many of you may know, scapegoating is so universal that it's actually been studied and observed in the animal kingdom. There have been studies in which they've taken, famous for torturing rats. There are now laws, we can't as much, but they took rats and they just randomly shocked them, for no reason, just randomly shocked them. And then they threw in a toy rat in the cage, and the rats tore that toy apart. So, and we all do it. I mean, we have a rough day at work, and we get angry at the kids. I mean, it's a common problem, something we have to be careful about. Sometimes this excessive and exclusive type of sibling rivalry is really scapegoating. It's the child's frustration. And then, if you have a situation like that, that's where it's just outside the realm of normal sibling rivalry, that's when you have to start doing some self-scrutiny or looking into the child if something's wrong, if it's very sudden. Let's say the kids had the normal kind of relationship where they're getting along great and they're fighting, and then suddenly one day out of no place, suddenly one kid in particular is just going after the other one with a vengeance, then you have to suspect that maybe something happened to that child, and that then you have to look that way. About the extreme forms of sibling rivalry, roles that people get into. Again, if a kid is being, let's say a situation where there is an older and stronger sibling, I think that may be along the lines of what you're talking about, who is by nature a very aggressive kid. And the immediate younger sibling is a more placid, easygoing kind of kid. What can happen is, because of that type of interplay, that they identify themselves or they see themselves as these kind of people, and it becomes part of their identity. In other words, again, I'm differentiating between the sort of more normal sibling rivalry where, you know, they push, they shove, they call each other names, and then it's over, but where one clearly either tortures the other one or where one so clearly dominates the other one because it is stronger. And usually it's not even a matter of strength, by the way. It usually has more to do with an aggressiveness. You'll find that that's more important because sometimes a kid who may not be as strong, et cetera, as big, but if he has that sort of aggressive position, if he has sort of that backbone, he stands up even to an older brother. So then that person can fall into a role, can become sort of their identity. And then even outside of the home, they lapse into that. They're always the one giving in, or et cetera, or for that matter, the bully becomes like a professional bully. If something like that is emerging, that's a time when you more actively intervene. That's a time when you try to help the kid. You know, you might actually say, because I said earlier that in sibling rivalry, less is more. The less you get involved, the better off it is. The more you want them to work out their differences. But if working out their differences isn't the normal kind of conflict resolution or isn't the kind of conflict resolution that you want to promote, then you get involved. And then that might be a situation where you might even say, like, let's say they're habitually fighting over who gets the computer, and one of the kids always gives in. By the way, it could be the older kid also. Sometimes you have that, where the younger kid is the aggressive go-getter, and the older one is the more placid one. If they're getting locked into a role, and again, if you don't know, fast forward to adulthood. If they're that kind of person as adults, if they're the kind of people adults who always give in, who always passively comply, that won't help them. Then you get in, you can say, no, that's not a suitable solution. No, that's not okay with me. Sometimes you get what my mother used to call in Latin, the gitanar. You mean the good fool. You know, the person, so that's usually a girl, who always gives in because she wants to make peace, she's a people pleaser, etc. If it's excessive, and again, if you think that's not going to be helpful to them, you can say, no, that's not acceptable to me. And by the way, I'm backtracking a little bit, even in normal sibling rivalry. And as I said, again, as much as possible, you should try to give the reins over to the children. Let the children be the ones who work out the differences. Let's say they can't. You keep sending them back and saying, all right, if you want the computer, you got to work out a schedule how you share it. And no matter how hard they try, they can't. That may be a time, and so now I'm going back to normal sibling rivalry, that may be a time where you get involved, but you get involved as little as possible. You want as much as possible for them to come up with a solution. So you might say to them then, okay, come here. What do you think could be a solution to this problem? Why doesn't each of you write down three possible solutions, and let's see from that if we can work something out. So you're coaching them, you're helping them, again, you're training them in conflict resolution. But again, you want them, in the normal circumstances, you want them to come up with a solution. Here in a situation where a kid's locked in a role, where a kid's, let's say, the constant passive complier, or in other words, another kid is constantly dominating, then you can come in and, again, you're the parent, you're the boss. And you can say, that's not acceptable, no, I'm sorry, you've given in all the time, that's not good, I want you sometimes to have your way as well. Or sometimes maybe you can speak to the child individually and say, that's not acceptable to me. Okay, let me just see if there's anything else, and then maybe we have some time for some give and take. Okay, one more thing, and that alludes to something that this gentleman said over here as well. Any time with children, anything that goes on, it will be, you know, what you model and what you display will also have some bearing. For that matter, how you get along with your siblings currently will be a model and will be something that they're going to look at as a model of how they should get along with their siblings. Or for that matter, and again, I mentioned earlier, sometimes you hear stories about siblings who fought, you know, killed each other, were fighting tooth and nail, and now suddenly are getting along beautifully. There's nothing wrong with telling kids that, because sometimes they think that their relationship's going to be like this the rest of their lives. And you can say, look how well we get along, and we used to fight a lot as well. But not only, again, as I'm saying, the two key lessons of sibling rivalry is conflict resolution and getting over, you know, accepting the inequities in life. If you're constantly complaining about other people that have more, if you're not happy with your lot, or if you're constantly looking and comparing, your children are going to do that with each other as well. In fact, I'll tell you one thing that I've done, and I tend to be somewhat sarcastic and make a lot of enemies this way, but sometimes when my children complain, my children will say, well, you know, the cones let the children go to sleep at 11 o'clock. I'll say, well, you have to understand the difference between the cones and the Blumenthals. The cones love their children. But they don't... most people don't like that solution, and you know, I'm interested in trying to drum up some business for my colleagues, so I do these kind of things. Or sometimes even I'll say to my kids when they complain about some inequity that, you know, you gave him more ice cream, so I love him more. But it's displacing it. But if you are, in fact, let me tell you a very interesting study. How are we doing time-wise? Okay, I mean, very quick, because I'm pretty much wrapping up, so I have a little time for some give and take. A very interesting study that was done. You have to pay attention a little bit, but it speaks to this issue of comparing, okay? About 5 years ago, psychologists woke up and said, you know, for years and years and years, we're studying why people are unhappy, why people are depressed. Let's study why people are happy. And they did a whole bunch of studies. They couldn't call it happiness because it doesn't sound scientific. See, brave people come late and sit right next to the teacher. Look at that. That's great. Okay. They couldn't just call it happiness because that doesn't sound scientific. So they called it SWB, subjective well-being, just happiness, okay? And they did a number of things. They did the following study. They assessed people's levels of happiness. So they divided, let's say, for simplistic sake, they divided people into happy people and unhappy people. Then they gave them a task to do. And next to them was somebody else doing the same task, but unbeknownst to them, that person was a Confederate. That person was from the study. And they fixed it in such a way that no matter how well the person did on that task, the guy next to them always did better. So the guy got, let's say on the test, the guy got a 95, the guy next to him got 100. If he got a 65, the guy next to him got a 70. But no matter what, the person next to them always did better. Now listen carefully to what they found. They found that happy people who did poorly on the task left the situation more content than unhappy people who did well on the task, because the guy next to them did better. So basically the point was that unhappy or happy people don't compare. Happy people aren't looking over their shoulder to see who's doing better or who has more. Unhappy people are busy looking and judging, etc. So if your kids are preoccupied with who has what, etc., maybe you have to, and again, we're not, you know, there's no better mirror of our souls than our children. You know, we can't see ourselves. Maybe we're mumbling under our breath when we walk by our neighbor and we see his new Lexus, you know. Maybe we're doing something, and we have to then think back and we have to consider whether we're actually modeling this. And the same thing goes with conflict resolution. How are we resolving conflicts with our spouses? How are we resolving conflicts with our siblings, with our neighbors, with our coworkers? And if we're not modeling appropriate degrees of assertiveness and compromise, then our children are not going to be able to do it either, and they're going to experiment with their siblings. I think I've pretty much covered everything that I can think of at this point. maybe we can open it up for some give and take, or if they're unresolved, then go ahead. Yeah. Okay, so that's a very good question in terms of really fits much more into a talk about self-esteem, but the whole issue of complimenting children. And we have to compliment our children. We have to applaud our children. Huh? Right, in front of the other one. It's okay, even in front of the other one. The worst thing you can do is compliment the child for something they're not good at, because they're not stupid, and they know. So you take a guy with two left feet who can't dribble a ball. I have to tell you, I have a friend in my neighborhood who, when he was growing up, he was like the worst athlete in the world. He couldn't catch a ball for anything, and he was always being, you know, picked on, and always the last one chosen on a team. And today, he lives in the same neighborhood with a lot of these kids he grew up with, but he's an obstetrician. And he says that's God's revenge because he's catching these guys' children, you know. So, he's payback. But you know, you say to a kid, "Oh, you're such a great athlete." You're hurting the child more because the child knows you're faking. Compliments, and it's important to compliment children, but the compliments have to be suited to the kid. So granted, and let's say again, you have two kids close in age, and one's an incredible athlete, and one's not so good. And you say in front of both of them, you're a great athlete. There's nothing wrong with that, because that's life. Because in the course of life, there are going to be people who have skills that you don't have, that you wished you had, and they're going to get a lot of kudos for that. You have to learn how to cope with that. Now, does that mean you don't compliment the child for what he's good at? Of course, you compliment him for what he's good at as well. But you're not, again, unless it's done excessively, if you're not doing the child a favor by withholding the compliment, because that's not what's going to happen to him in life. And in life, there will be situations where people are going to get recognition and credit that you wish you could get that you're not getting. Now, the problem is, I'll get you in a second, okay? The problem is when there is a major disparity between two, let's say, as I mentioned earlier, with the triplets there or with twins, where there is a child born, let's say, with some sort of delays, disabilities, etc. Now, I'm not talking about anything even excessive, but I'm talking about some of the minor delays, et cetera, but the ones that make enough of an impact, and the other kid is a superstar. And that's very difficult, and in fact, by the way, that is sometimes even a risk factor for problems, because, when we talk about risk factors for difficulties, one of them is having a sibling or a parent who is quite exceptional. In fact, I often say it's one reason why I'm purposely staying very mediocre for my children's sake, because I don't want them to have that struggle. You know, I'm doing a very good job at it too. But so that's already a much more difficult situation, and there you have to sort of compensate as much. First of all, to find those areas where the child does well, but there you have to compensate some more often with the affection, with the kissing, with the warmth, because you can't lie to a child. Yeah, you can't.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you don't want to put them in a role that. Okay, I mean, to some extent, yeah, okay, yeah, I hear what you're saying, although it may be just a natural kind of thing. One of the things, by the way, that happens, you hear again and again from parents that they can't believe the two siblings are from the same family because they're so different. I think we all have a need for a distinct identity. We all need for a distinction. So sometimes what happens is the second kid looks at the first one and says, "That's who I'm not going to be." So you get a lot of that kind of polarization. That's nothing out of the ordinary. If it's accurate, if the kid who's really got great social skills really is inherently capable of doing well in school but is defining himself that way, that's a different story. But it could very well be that that's who he is. And let me tell you something in terms of what I've observed, maybe you've observed it as well. Very often, the people with the social intelligence do a lot better in life than those with the academic intelligence. You know, so they say that one college president once said that you should treat your C students better than your A students. Your A students are going to become professors. Your C students are going to become businessmen. They're going to be the ones who are going to endow the school later on. You were anxious in the back. Did I say something? Yeah.
Yes.
Sure. Right.
Mm-hmm. And I find out what my husband and I are dealing with are, you can't get to them fast enough to reduce the suggestion that they should find a solution to their own problems.
Right.
Because within 5 seconds or less, there's already been a kick.
Or right, right. They're already broken bones. Right,
right. How do you deal with a situation like that?
Right, sure. I had a friend once who was talking to one of his daughters and saying that, you know, you hit your sister on purpose. She said, no, I didn't. I said, no, I saw you hit your sister on purpose. She said, no, hitting on purpose is when you make them bleed. You're right, that sometimes it happens very, very quickly. There are, and that's beyond what we're supposed to talk about here, there are techniques, interventions for children with these kind of impulse problems. And it's really, that's already a separate issue. Just without going into great details, you have to sensitize them to the buildup. You have to let them know so they can catch themselves. There are methods, there are interventions for something like that. The other thing, by the way, is that if it is, I'm not adverse to this, generally speaking, by the way, you want, as I said, you want children to have sibling rivalry. It's normal, and they learn skills that way. If it is so excessive and if it's out of hand, then there is nothing wrong with, you know, saying to them, you guys got to be apart for a while. Sometimes even just a period of time, if you have like a moratorium where they're apart, then things can settle and then you can sort of reintroduce them to each other, especially then you have some time to teach the child some more self-control skills. You're anxious to say something. Go ahead.
I was asking about, if you have children that are close in age, mm-hmm. and talking about excessive rivalry, not in the degree, but how often it happens or it happens often.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's very competitive kind of rivalry. Me first, and you spend more time with him than with me. And as much as you say life is not fair, they're still comparing all the time. You know, why he got this and I got that? Why did you go first? Why spend all the time with him and not with me? And
right.
Done enough that they don't understand. Then how can you?
I mean, they can't understand yet. They can.
They don't get.
No, let me tell you something. They, I'm going to correct you. The kids don't present us with challenges unless they're ready to do it, unless they're ready to deal with it. If they're already caught up in this, then they're ready to learn that lesson. In other words, they have reached the understanding of the world that there is such a thing as inequity, and therefore they're posing you with that problem. They wouldn't pose it to you if they weren't ready to deal with it. So I'm going to sort of, it's maybe audacious on my part, but I'm going to assume that, no, if they're caught up in this, then it's, you know, then they're ready for it. Now, what I'm going to say, correct me if I'm paraphrasing question wrong, I'll get to you in a minute, okay? I'll get to everybody. But you're saying it's so excessive that it's not what I'm, not like what I'm saying where it's periodic and within, in between. It's just, it's a major, major preoccupation. They're one of, and let's say you've ruled out anything else going on. There aren't other stressors. There aren't that. This is the normal thing. If it is so excessive, first of all, you put, again, the onus of responsibility on both of them. If I hear one more time about three, oh, great, okay. Give you a lot of credit. There's some things called medication. for the parents, not for the kids, yeah. Right. And housekeepers, there's all sorts of stuff, you know. I have one parent tell me that she had a friend over from a very fancy schmancy home, and she watched, you know, and this woman was making the beds in her house, and she looked at her friend and said, oh, your mommy's not only a mommy, she's also a housekeeper? But at any rate, the if it is, you know, again, the onus of responsibility is on both of them. If I keep hearing both of you, I'm first, we're not going to go. You can even do, if they're young enough, say, now go back to your room and come back and I don't want to hear this, I'm first. Again, putting it on both of them. Now you're not taking sides, and now they got to figure out how to solve this themselves. If it's really out of control, and it's so much so, and again, here's the criteria. If you feel that it's so, they're so caught up with it, they're so preoccupied that they're not learning, they're not progressing, they're on like, you know, that treadmill, they're going no place, then you take over. Then you say, you know what, odd even days. That's it. You know, then you take over. Then you're modeling for them, for example. And instead of having them do it, you're sort of modeling for them a solution. It sounds like they're very young. If they're a little older, then you put the onus on them. So, look, we have a problem with who goes first, who goes second, or the age-old problem, who sits in the front? You know, what do they call the seat with the, you know, Shotgun, yeah. Who rides shotgun? Right. The shotgun. Who rides shotgun? If they can't figure it out themselves, then you solve it. But again, not because you want to take over for them, but now you're modeling. And in fact, you can make that instruction. You see how easy it was to solve it. We picked up some sort of objective criteria and we made it to see how easy it is to solve these problems. Then, so even if you have to take over, you're bestowing on them the ability to try to make those solutions. Yeah, I'm anxious to say something about that. Yeah.
Based on the inherent personality traits that I think that children
100% correct, yes.
So then you have positioning with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So now you have the position. So my thing is, let's say you have four kids, but there's always like that one kid that will aggravate all the three other kids.
Mm-hmm.
But what happens if you have like these three kids and then years later you have a fourth kid? Well, you know which kid's going to be the one. It's the third kid because of the positioning in the family.
Well,
let's say you've had these three children.
Right.
And then many years later you have a fourth child.
Right.
But it's your third child that has problems with the two older siblings and the younger siblings.
Right. Is there a major age disparity between that child and the younger one?
Yeah.
Okay. 6 years, okay, yeah,
but
okay. Is it not normal? It's unusual. It's unusual. Yeah.
Then
right.
You have to go further.
It could be a general insecurity, a general sense that they're feeling disadvantaged. By the way, I should correct one thing I'm saying, and I want to echo, resonate with something you said also. Every time a new sibling comes into the home, or for that matter, when a sibling leaves the home, they go off to college, to Israel, or something like that, the whole complexion, all relationships change. Even sometimes when they go away for a weekend, all the alliances sort of change. So it's a natural, normal thing that everybody shifts and moves around and goes through a transitional period, even if there is a big age disparity when a new child comes along. That's not your typical sibling rivalry. That's just the alliances shifting, etc. You're correct also, by the way, and I'm glad you mentioned this, that people are not, you know, we tend to look very much at the environment, but kids are born with what we call temperaments. And any nurse in a nursery will tell you that. Some kids are just naturally aggressive. Some kids are more naturally placid. Some kids are naturally, I think, even more jealous. They're just like, you know, they're more observant. You know, I think it's not that they're born jealous, but they're very acutely aware of their surroundings. So they're aware of some of the disparities. Some kids have a much harder time with injustice. You know, so there are inherent differences. And that... Okay, well, it depends. Again, if it's... The truth of the matter is, since God made us so different, there's many different ways to be successful functioning adults. So you can be a successful adult as an aggressive person, and you can be a successful adult as a less aggressive person. A certain amount of aggressiveness we all need. A certain amount of ability to compromise and bend we all need. But it's a range. So the kid who is born, let's say, is a very aggressive kind of kid, can be a very successful adult, can engage in conflict resolution, can handle life's inequities, but he'll handle it differently than the more you know, stereotypical Californian. Okay, but again, they still need these skills. There's nobody in the world who can always has to always have their way. I don't care how aggressive and competent and bright they are. They'll always meet a situation where they can have their way. So they may handle it differently, but everybody needs these skills in their own fashion, in their own way. A kid, you know, I hear what you're saying. Sometimes kids are just, it happens to be their position in such a way in a family that it almost seems like they're getting the raw end of the deal. You know, like they're just sort of like, you know, they're getting it from one end to the other end, a kid's sandwiched between very difficult kids, or sometimes, and it's again, it's a situation of itself. Let's say an immediate sibling is a kid who needs a lot of attention. Suppose a kid is born and the next immediate sibling has difficulties, has developmental delays, has medical ailments, etc., or is just a needy kind of kid. So you have those and those kind of inequities. And if it's a medical thing, then they feel guilty putting the bands on the parents, and then they learn to just sort of take things in. And again, all these are special situations that require a unique perspective. But it can happen that a kid is just in a position, and if you're aware of that, and basically what I would tell you is if the sibling rivalry is such that it's so intense that they're not learning from it, that it's just consuming them, then you intervene, and then you reduce it, or then you do something to give them their own unique... Right. Okay. What does this mean? 3 minutes. Yeah, I know. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. When it comes to something like that, then you need to more actively intervene. It has, in other words, it's almost like giving medication. It's like, you know, the doctors talk about titrating, making sure you have the right dosage. The kids need the right dosage of sibling rivalry. If it's too little or too much, too little would be when you have this sterile environment, everybody has their own room, everybody has their own TV, and you're portioning, again, you're counting the bubbles in the Pepsi Cola. That's too little. But too much is if it's so excessive that it's more painful than instructive, then you reduce it, you control it as the parent, then you intervene, then you take a kid like that and give them their own room. Or something like that. Oh my God. Suddenly I must open a can of worms. I think you raised your hand first. Go ahead. Yeah. I know you're right here. Yeah, yeah. Always the case, yeah. I mean, if they're together.
When they're together.
Right.
Without a friend or an activity, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because simply they're not as mature. And
mm-hmm. Right.
So, you'd... Even though I've tried other scenarios to, take them away and separate them, but they just want to be all the time together.
Both want to be together.
Pretty much.
Uh-huh.
Most of the time.
Because usually the older one doesn't want the little one around. Well, that's an unusual, yeah. Uh-huh.
But so how...
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
so let me ask you. Okay.
Now
I'll tell you what you do. When you have the younger one has friends over, watch and see if the younger one gets into the same role with the contemporaries, with the peers, as he or she does with the older sibling. In other words, your concern is the younger one now learning to be more dependent, passive, etc. Or maybe the older one being domineering. But let's just worry about the younger one. So, listen with a little extra ear when they have friends over. And is she like that with her peers outside of that relationship? If she is, then you have to intervene. Because you don't want that to be their behavior repertoire. Okay? Yeah, I think you're anxious to say something also, right?
Question?
Yeah, right. Go ahead. Yeah,
how much, I'm going to scrub situation. I want to know if this is normal. So I'm
sure.
My two oldest girls are about a year and a half apart.
That's abnormal.
Oh,
no, sorry.
and they're the ones who kind of cat.
Yeah.
Now, they're not always at each other, but there seems like over the last years of this.
Oh, okay. That's the last question. Yeah, okay, yeah.
And they won't even always fight, but there's like little things. And so they're less, these to be great friends, and now they're
don't worry about it. Don't worry
just,
about it.
Just leave it.
It's leave it.
Okay.
Leave
no,
it. They'll work it. They'll love each other more if you don't get involved. Let them work it out themselves, then they'll love each other. It's the parents who say, how can you not love your sister? You have to love your sister.
So it's okay
for hundred. Yeah, that's normal. It's the normal stuff. They go into each other's closets. They take each other's clothing. And okay, yeah, I understand. Why don't we just talk?
I was late, I know. Yeah. But I just want to know one question. Are you opposed to giving consequences for sibling rivalry?
Okay. The only thing you have to be careful, you have to be very careful because sometimes it looks like one kid is the agitator, but it's so subtle. And especially this, they read each other. The kid goes like, and you didn't see it. You're always better off. You're always better off putting the onus of responsibility on all the kids. Okay? I grew up in one. Okay? Thank you very much. That's very helpful. Thank you. Okay. No, let me.